Good morning on Tuesday, July 10th. You're listening to Brian and Gabe and Jack live from San Francisco. This is Brian Madden in our studio in Tech Target, sitting next to Jack.
Good morning, everybody.
And in Omaha, you've got me, although no video this week, this month. I don't know. How often do we do these things anymore?
Well, there's some vacation time in there. I'm happy to be back. You know, I was on vacation last week, and the purpose when we created the show originally, the purpose was because Gabe and I spent a lot of time talking to each other, just catching up and sharing ideas and thoughts and stuff. And we kind of thought, hey, this would be cool. I bet other people want to hear these conversations. And so far we have shown that 11 people do want to.
I'd like to note that Gabe's 2-week-long vacation ended right before the holiday week when nobody was working anyway.
Smart. Jack, that's what 16 years in the business will teach you, those little tricks. So let me see. So much to talk about. I figure let's kind of jump right in. And in random order, what do we say? What do I have first? Dell closed the Wyze acquisition. Okay, right. So let's start with this, with Dell, right? So we got Dell. They announced that they were buying Wyze. And then I think while I was on vacation, they announced they were buying Quest. So I want to hear about that because I know you did a lot of articles about that, but I haven't read up on it. But I will say first, I had a briefing from Dell. So on the Wyze side of things, I had a briefing from them 2 weeks ago. And so that the Wyze deal is done. They're fully integrated. If you go to Dell.com, and I was looking at buying a sort of a cheap desktop, and it has like thin, now it says like, you know, desktops, laptops, and thin clients. Like it's on the site, like right there. But it was funny though, because, and I think I might have tweeted this, that I go to this briefing, and it's cool. So it's Rafael Colorado, if you know him from Dell, and Jeff McNaught, who many of you know from Wyze, were there in this briefing. And I noticed that Jeff McNaught had a Dell laptop, like an actual laptop, which is funny because from the past 5 years that I've known him, he's always been like, nah, man, thin client laptops are awesome. I'm like, dude, you travel all the time. He's like, no, it's okay. You know, it's Windows XP embedded. And I'm like, God, I don't know. And he was always all about thin client laptops. And then the instant he works for Dell, oh, look at that. He's got a real laptop.
That's funny. It's probably an Ultrabook or something too.
It was. Yeah, they actually looked kind of nice. Although I'm still looking for this is a whole different conversation, but it's still no, like even
and,
these,
and one that we can get to, but yeah, like you just can't beat your MacBook Air as far as price and build and all that stuff goes compared to the price of those things. But we can, I'm sure that we'll get there in due time for this stuff. But I mean, yeah, Dell's been busy.
Yeah,
a lot of the articles and stuff out there. What's that?
And then MacBook Airs will have holographic screens.
Right. And Retina displays and all that. A lot of the articles about all the Dell activity now is just saying that Dell's just on a buying spree, and you know how Dell's stock is down, and so you know they're out there just trying to grow in different markets, and so they're just out there spending money left and right. So who knows? You know, I guess $2.4 billion on the Quest acquisition. I don't remember what Wyze. Did we get a number for Wyze, Brian?
I thought we knew the number, but I don't remember what it was. Like 500 million or 800, 500?
I had 600. 6 in my head, but yeah, I don't know for sure anyway. It's not, yeah. But either way, so Dell's out there. I mean, they've dropped around $3 billion in the last 3 months or something on companies that are in our space, and of course the Quest acquisition is way beyond our space too. But I mean, holy cow, that's a lot of growth, or at least a lot of anticipated growth.
So what's the story? Because I know that Dell buying Quest, when it was rumored, you know, a few weeks ago, and they, you know, I think we wrote an article then that sort of talked about what this was for, and you know, it wasn't really around V Workspace and that kind of stuff, but. In the week that I've been gone, like, what was the conversation about? Do we know anything more from Quest and what they're trying to do? Or I don't know if you talked to John Rolls or any of those guys who we know there.
I sent emails to people that I know. John was among them, and everything got pushed to PR, which makes sense. I mean, you know, in a time like that, nobody's really allowed to talk and stuff. So I don't know. What I know actually comes from Bridget Botello, who writes for Search Virtual Desktop. among other sites. And she actually had a quote from Jeff McNaught saying that with the Quest acquisition and the Wyze acquisition, customers would now have one throat to choke when it comes to their desktop virtualization.
But that's crazy, yeah. Though. Like, Dell's got
so
such a strong.
Coming amidst also, well, hang on. So, but that quote came amidst all this discussion of whether or not Quest was even or Dell was even going to keep the desktop virtualization parts of Quest, because you know Quest is such a big company, and there's no way Dell would pay $2.4 billion for vWorkspace. Dell's paying for database monitoring and security applications and things like that. Like Dell's paying for Quest's entire software lineup, and desktop virtualization is that's a small part of that. And so it was kind of up in the air at one point. There were some vague mentions of Quest's user workspace management stuff, but they really focused in the press releases and on the analyst briefings about we like it for the security aspects, we like it for the fog light, the database monitoring, that kind of a thing, the Windows Server management stuff, and just a passing mention to user workspace, which is the new group that vWorkspace and all the other ChangeBase and Remote Scan and all of those guys belong to.
So that was
so hearing Jeff say, "Hey, now there's one throat to choke." That at least gives us the indication that Wyze's perception is that Quest or that vWorkspace will still be part of the lineup, even as part of Dell.
And I guess we don't know if that Dell deal, like, that probably has the Quest deal even closed yet? So maybe that's what they can't really talk
about. Right. And so that's expected to close in Q3, but Dell's fiscal quarters I'm sure I sound like a newbie with this, but Dell's fiscal quarters are different than like the normal.
Is it Dell's Q3? Because yeah, I think Dell's offset by like a month and a half or something weird. Yeah.
Right. So I think that Dell's Q3 from past dealings with Dell, I think that their Q3 starts at the end of July, maybe first part of August. I think maybe Q2 ends in July. And then Q3 starts in,
So anyway, so it closes. So I guess that explains why Quest can't say anything.
So we're a month away from closing, I think, at least. Yeah. So that explains the radio silence and things like that. But and to be fair, in the analyst briefing, they did mention that the user workspace management was part of it. I just there's this unfortunate time where Quest went and renamed. They created a user workspace management group. They renamed vWorkspace to Quest Workspace Desktop Virtualization, and then Dell bought them. So now there's all these different things going on and all these different names going on and things like that. And so while Dell never said vWorkspace, they did say User Workspace Management, and vWorkspace is part of that.
Because that was technically the product name, even though it was only the product name for like a week and a half.
Yes.
Man,
yeah,
we got
exactly.
A new semantic over here with all these different products and names. And
yeah, no kidding.
So
I wrote a couple of things. I wrote one, breaking down the acquisition or breaking down the announcement of the acquisition, and then another one clarifying, mentioning what Jeff McNaught said about one throat to choke, mentioning that vWorkspace has been renamed. Good luck getting people to stop calling it vWorkspace for the time being. But and it was on a minor release too. They went from 7.5 to 7.6 and changed the name, which is odd. But and then they also released a user environment virtualization solution. As well, or an updated version of their user environment management solution. So Quest, regardless of whether Quest was busy on their own, apart from the Dell acquisition, and then you combine those two things together, and it has been, last week was like Quest Week 2012.
So imagine, and I actually didn't read the articles that you wrote last week, so I don't know if you talked about this. If not, maybe this is something I can write for tomorrow. So we already talked about in the past how Quest had so many different products across their whole portfolio. Like they had like SSL VPN products and identity management and Active Directory sort of management stuff that could hook into the vWorkspace and that sort of thing. And like if Quest actually got their shit together, they had all the raw working pieces to sort of almost go head to head with like a VMware or a Citrix in the desktop virtualization space. And what's interesting now, so Quest like already kind of had that stuff. So on the one hand, we talk about Dell not wanting to compete against Citrix or VMware, but think about all
the stuff. I think they are, though. I mean, with Jeff saying one throat to choke.
Yeah, but he doesn't. Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah.
In response to Dell acquiring Quest, too. It wasn't just like Dell Dell and Wise. This was Bridget asking him in the context of Dell acquiring Quest.
So here's the, for, as far as, are we sure about that?
Well, that was the article framing.
Oh yeah. Okay. Cool. Cause I'm very, I feel like I've got a good skill at taking quotes out of context. So maybe that's not, but
it could be, but the article was specifically about the Quest acquisition and Jeff was quoted in that context. So,
oh, okay, cool. All right.
Yeah.
But so check this out. So, okay. We talked about Quest. If Quest could get all their shit together, you know, look at the amazing stuff they could do against like a Citrix or a VMware. Now consider you've got the Wise components, which think of all Wise as software. You got Pocket Cloud. You have the virtual desktop accelerator. You have the streaming components. I forget what this stuff is called. Why am I blanking on it? Wise.
So there's the desktop provisioning stuff is Wise Workstation Manager. They've got the device management stuff with Wise Stratus. They've got Quest user workspace management, all of that stuff, but I guess the user environment management. The Wise Thing clients, they've got the secure remote access stuff that Quest has, yeah. And then Dell already has SonicWall firewalls, so if they can
that's what I was going to say, before we even get to Dell stuff, look at all the software that Wise has. So they have the VDA, that Virtual Desktop Accelerator,
the Wise stuff specifically,
which is, and they also have the, TCX is what I was trying to think of, right?
The protocol, sure.
Yeah, and Pocket Cloud, that's all just purely in the software from Wise. So you get all that combined with all of Quest stuff within the user workspace portfolio and with the broader Quest. Now think of Dell, SonicWall you mentioned, Force 10, which is like huge, you know, data center base, like NetScaler type things almost.
But that's all the switching fabric and stuff too now. It's the Force 10 stuff.
Yeah.
So this is virtualization aware switches that go way beyond those Power Connect things that we used to run in our data center.
Yeah,
I mean, this is, and I don't know, you know, the networking guys in the world might be like, ha, Force 10, whatever. But, you know, from an on-paper standpoint, I mean, that looks like a fairly complete network solution.
Yeah,
as
and
well.
Then think about, they've got Case. And they've got, who else did Dell buy?
So they've got some backup and data management stuff. Well, they got some backup. Dell bought a company called Apashure that handles backups and things like that, but like actual inside virtual machine kind of backups. So a little bit more than just, you know, your regular backup exec or CA type stuff. And then Quest has NetVault, which was something to do with like backup for different storage arrays. So, or data management for like data center based storage. So those two things have a synergy that they mentioned in that analyst call. So, I mean, these are the things they've already planned on. Not to mention, like, they've already got all the storage. They've already got the desktops. They've already got the servers.
And don't forget,
all of that.
And don't forget that Dell, Quest, and Wise all have mobile device management solutions.
Oh, really?
So what's Quest mobile device management solution?
The Quest management extensions.
The QMX stuff for System Center?
Yeah, that's what they offer as their MDM solution. So in the world of like mainstream MDM providers kind of they're like, oh, that's not real, you know, MDM.
I mean, well, so I was going to ask you if that counts, because I wrote something about MDM for Search Virtual Desktop and or where desktop virtualization and consumerization kind of come together. And somebody from Quest emailed me and said, is there a reason that Quest was left out of that list of MDM providers? And I emailed back and said, can you show me what Quest MDM product is? And then they never responded to me.
Well, it's if you can distribute configuration profiles, then you have MDM. But just distributing configuration profiles and is a long way from what the mobile irons and the AirWatches and the Zen Prize, and you know they do way more than that.
All right, so at least okay. So since this is happening, this acquisition's happening, Jack Madden, do you think that Quest has an MDM solution?
Technically, yes.
Don't qualify.
Okay.
Yet.
Well, it's fine. It doesn't matter because there's three of them now, and they'll sort it out, and they'll actually have an MDM solution when it's done. It's probably going to be Wise's, I would think, just based on. You know, with as much talk as we've had about these things and how complete Wise it seems to be. So
didn't Wise buy someone to get that also?
Yeah, they did. And I don't remember the name of that offhand. That was like last September or October or something.
Incidentally, these configuration profiles, so because if all you have to do is get the configuration profiles of the user, can you mail it to them as an attachment? Like say, hey, open this attachment from your iPhone to make it good performance, and then really just locks it down and like removes the app store and stuff.
That sounds like a spam. Open this on your iPhone to make good performance.
Naked pictures, click here, and then it's a spam from your own IT department. Well, I'm writing that one down.
Actually, yes. But, you know, you will be taken through some warning screens that says, like, you know, your IT department has the power to do all this to your phone. But you can always just remove the profile anytime you want.
Oh, that's what you told me today. So, like, this is talk about that because I never heard about that.
You know, so as I'm digging through the the opaque world of figuring out how Apple and Android mobile device management actually works, you know, the standard response for Apple MDM is to just look at the iPhone configuration utility, look at the line server profile manager, and you look at all the features in there. And you think, okay, that's like the baseline of how iOS MDM works. Except there's some of these features that are available through those Apple products, but they don't release to third-party MDM providers. one of which is the ability to make profiles be able to be locked onto the device. So you get that with Apple MDM, but not other products.
So you can literally... Okay, so lock in... So, okay... If I'm using a third party MDM to deliver the configuration profile to my iOS device, so as a user, I can at any time go into like this is the preferences or whatever, and like remove that configuration profile, right?
Yeah, but they can also make it so that they're like, well, screw you. We're also going to turn off your email. And
Right. So like it's still secure for the company. Like yeah, it's just that if I remove it, then I might not have the corporate apps or I might not have the certificate to get on the VPN, all that kind of stuff, whatever.
Right.
But with Apple, you can literally take away the button. Like, so using Apple's, what is it, Lion Server Profile?
There's Lion Server Profile Manager. There's the Apple Configurator.
Which is, since Apple doesn't make servers anymore, you run the Lion Server Profile Manager on a Mac Mini sitting at your desk?
It's instead of being in the data center, it's like under somebody's desk.
But if you use Apple's, then you can make it so it's locked on. But if you use anyone else's, you can't make it so it's locked on.
Right.
Yeah. How's that not anti? I don't know. Well. Hey. So what's the so the anonymous says MDM. What's the point? If everyone wanted MDM, they would still be using BlackBerries. This goes
game
back
set match.
Wait, should I read it like this? Let me read it in that poster's original accent. MDM, what's the point, eh? but here's the thing is with this though, but users, like if everyone wanted MDM, they'd still be using BlackBerries, but isn't that the whole point of why MDM exists for non-BlackBerry platforms? Because probably every IT pro in the company is like, guys, the only secure thing's a BlackBerry. And the users are like, right, so we're bringing in our own iPhones and Androids, and we're doing whatever we'll want with them. Isn't like the whole point, like to answer the poster's question, I think the point of MDM is that users don't want to use BlackBerries. So the reason that MDM, because Bez is MDM for BlackBerry, right? So that's all like... If you have just BlackBerries, fine. You're using Bez.
Right. But you have the advantages of the completely vertically integrated everything, and everything just works, and there are no cracks around the edge.
Yeah. If you take a time machine back to January 15th, 2007, then that was fine, right? I mean, that was fine. But yeah, to the poster's point. C says they want iPhones and Androids because they're not managed. I don't know if I believe that. Like, especially a lot of these MDM configuration profiles. You know, a lot like I feel like. So first of all, a lot of companies, it must not be a big deal to the company, because if it really was a big deal to the company, they would be using MDM today,
right?
But a lot of, I don't know. You can use MDM also for nice things like just configuring email and that kind of stuff. Like, I think it'd be cool. I mean, I don't know. I'd be okay if my company on my phone like used MDM so they could like push out the email configuration, push out the certificates to the network, and Like if there's apps, they're coming apps, so they put concurrent here for me. Like,
so that brings up the interesting question: does a configuration profile equal management?
Oh, because the configuration profile is
because they can always have
but not management. Yeah,
they can always have the configuration profile on the device and just not do anything with it. And you know, even though with the configuration profile on the device, the company can see what applications are installed, but you can always make it so that Joe admin can't actually see that you're, you know, what.
Oh yeah.
What applications that you have installed?
There's no way. There's no way for me to allow. Like, it'd be cool if, as a user, I could say I want my company to control my email settings, but I do not want them to control what applications. Like, I can't. If I accept a configuration profile, I'm not at the mercy for them to be a benevolent overlord.
Yeah.
And not like take away my App Store icon.
Yeah. So they can be that way. And so when we talk about mobile application management versus mobile device management, it comes down to that question: like, is an MDM configuration profile on the device, is that management? Are users okay with that?
And that's actually a good point to the commenter who's saying, you're telling me users want to have a whitelist of apps that are allowed? It's untenable anyway. It changes too fast. So fine, but we're not. But this is the thing: we don't have to associate MDM with only whitelisting applications, right? Because I think, to your point, Jack, it's just like desktop management today. So maybe everyone uses desktop management, but some people use it for just the basic stuff, like, you know, make sure the apps are installed you need, make sure the login scripts run, that have your drives mapped and that kind of stuff. Whereas other people might use desktop management to totally lock down everything, policies so tight you can't even get to the start, you know, control pad, whatever, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Those are both called desktop management, even though it's different. It's like a sliding scale.
Yeah, yeah. But it also gets a lot different because, you know, people are actually bringing in their personal devices, you know, in mass. And so,
isn't,
you know,
that
they,
the thing
they,
with the – isn't that the benefit with the Citrix receiver stuff, where everything can be isolated within the Citrix receiver, so the phone can be the phone, it can be unmanaged, and we can just manage the little sandbox that everything else plays in?
Yeah, well, so is that a an introduction to the...
Call it a segue if you want. Yeah.
Well, but that's MAM though versus MDM, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So the idea with mobile application management is that you can put the password around just the application. You can make sure that just the application is encrypted, and you can have a remote kill switch in that application, and that all goes on the phone, and whatever is happening on the phone. Who cares what's happening on the phone?
And I would assume you can still tell if the phone is jailbroken or things like that, and just not allow anything to execute if the phone has been compromised in some way or rooted or.
Yeah, especially because you actually have applications on the ground, for lack of a better term, like on the phone, that are right there and can see what's going on, actually better than a configuration profile without an agent application.
I know some of the.
So we.
I was going to say the jailbreak detection is cool because some of these MAM vendors, the way they detect jailbreaking is they just try and they just use an API call that's blocked in the regular iPhone that's unlocked in jailbreaking. If that wins, they're like, whoops, you're jailbroken. And then depending on the admin can configure, like, it could be like literally when you try and fire up and it detects jailbroken, it's like, nope, I'm out of here. And it just kills itself, which is kind of cool.
Well, so we talk about this quite a bit, maybe not necessarily out in the open like this, but, you know, we go to all these conferences and things, we talk about this. And frankly, in my mind, MAM, I feel like these are mutually exclusive. Well, no, I don't. I feel like they occupy the same space in one way where, like, they're two completely different technologies, but I would assume you either have MDM or MAM. And I guess it's not entirely true, but I can't understand why you'd want to do MDM if there's an awesome MAM solution out there.
There's your segue.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, really, based on the article. But it just, the MAM solution sounds so cool and so, I want to say, nimble compared to the MDM where, like, you know, the Anonymous are saying, like, it's untenable to try to keep ahead of all the different changes and stuff that are going on out there, let alone the applications, that MAM just seems like the way to go, I mean, across the board.
I mean, but if you want to use the device management there, you know, maybe you're not going to use it to be blacklisting people's phones and wiping them or anything. But you know, there's the like the configuring people's Wi-Fi and you know, all those.
That's a good point, right?
Sending them people's email and all that you know, classic stuff. But so you know, so
think
so maybe
of MDM, like domain joining a phone, almost like just because a machine's domain joined, the user could still have its local admin rights. You just join it to the domain to give you another vector into what you can do to that machine. And you could, if you wanted to, use your powers for evil and pull off local admin rights and lock down everything.
Right.
But
well, you're right. And so MDM is rarely talked about in that simplistic way, though. So MDM is talked about as a, you know, like lord over the users, make sure that this happens and this happens, and policies and this and that, not just, you know, now you can have a little oversight if you want to.
Yeah. And I guess maybe it's our fault as like the blogosphere that we just want to like the big doom naysayer on, you know, like the evils of MDM.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've been trying to, you know, represent this fairly, I suppose.
Incidentally though, but to Gabe's point, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jack, it seems like most people are sort of agreeing that MAM is sort of like better and the future and more nimble and all this kind of stuff. Yet the promise of what MAM could be doesn't exist yet. Like, right? Because like, it seems like right now, like if you look at the various MAM vendors out there, like there's good, but good only works with applications that have been written to good's SDKs. So like, you know, of the 40 million, you know, apps in the world, they work with like, you know, whatever, like 20.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's like, you want to use Dropbox? Sorry, they didn't write it for good. But you can use Box, but what if you, you know, like those kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, this is where the whole, the technique of MAM comes in, you know, whether it's, you know, good is an SDK base, which you, all those management hooks and to make the apps communicate with each other, you bake that into the app when you build it. And, you know, there are advantages to that, and there are advantages to the other approaches of app wrapping, which is you take any old random app that comes out, you put your code around it, and suddenly now you have a kill switch, you have a password wall around it, and that's how a lot of these products work.
But the app wrapping, though, to me, the Achilles heel for that, or like the fatal flaw with that, is you can't app wrap apps that exist in the iOS app store, right? So for iPhone devices, you know, if you want to wrap an app, you have to go to the app developer and ask them nicely for the package files, like the same files that they submit to Apple, they have to give them to you so you can wrap it yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to be like, hey, I promise you I won't post it to a BitTorrent site so everyone can get it for free.
And if it's like, hey, I'm going to give my users the wrapped version of Evernote, and you know, you research that, they're like, well, what about this other regular version of Evernote that's out there in the App Store? So
never thought. Hey, mine doesn't have a print button. Oh, mine does. Oh,
yeah, yeah. And I got this one for free in the Apple App Store instead of having to get permission for it. Well, that's a great segue to another article that I wrote a couple of weeks ago, is that you can't use application management to to manage SaaS clients.
What do you mean?
Like if you're like, oh, I'm going to keep my users from using Evernote by only giving them the wrapped version of the Evernote, you know, iPad client. Like, not only is there the publicly available Evernote client, there's also the web version and the desktop version. Managing SaaS
client. So if you give them one version, they can just go use the web version and get all the features they want anyway. So there's no point, because you can't match the SaaS apps with your current solution.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to figure out a way to do that by identity. And then the thought goes, if you make all of your internal corporate apps that way as well, just make them all identity based, then like, who cares about managing them? If they're you know, if the app is floating around out there anyway, it, as long as it's useful without your AD role, then who cares?
That's And that's probably the ultimate fantasy. Like that's probably the long term direction, right?
Yeah, that, that's a fantasy of how. That's like my fantasy of how any company's internally developed mobile application works.
Right. And I guess we can add that on the shelf with my fantasy of your VPN around your data center instead of around your building, you know?
Exactly.
And both these things are like, in that world would be awesome. So it doesn't exist
so
today.
We're getting closer. If you're building corporate mobile applications right now, which, you know, like people are, you know, it's like, we're just starting to do this right now. Don't go and do it the wrong way, please. If you're building your application right now, you know, and you're building it in such a way that it can be, if it's out there, it's dangerous. Like, baby, you got off on the wrong foot.
Baby, you got problems.
You got yourself a problem.
So while we're on this kind of topic, Jack, I want to bring up this article that you wrote yesterday. Because it's kind of about MDM and MAM, and you wrote this article on Consumerized IT, what was it called? Why Citrix should not add mobile device management to Cloud Gateway. And so we were kind of talking about MDM versus MAM, and that MAM is maybe like the better way to go ultimately. Although, and Citrix Cloud Gateway, they announced at Synergy they're going to be adding MAM capabilities. So in addition,
yeah. I don't think they said Synergy specifically, but
okay, but because no, I mean, like at Synergy we learned, well, regardless, I guess.
At
Synergy in May we learned that they had something going on.
Yeah, the mobile application management, and which comes out this month.
Okay, so this is because the good news about this is because before Citrix's support, I'm using air quotes, Citrix's support for mobile devices has been like, oh, we can give you Windows applications on it, which is pretty worthless.
But then ShareFile came along, and so Citrix Receiver with ShareFile, there's that that little, you know, open in button, which means that suddenly you can open a file in whatever native application happens to be on your device instead of in ZenApp. So
follow me data.
Yeah. So that's like opening Pandora's box of native, and that's why, you know, around March, April, we were saying like that's why we're expecting to see actual application management from Citrix.
Right. Okay. So that was announced, and they're going to use I think it's app wrapping was their idea, right?
Right.
Which has all the benefits and drawbacks we just mentioned. But so now, did I miss this while I was out? Like this story about, so I mean, fill us in, because so we thought they were going to do the MAM approach, not the MDM approach. And we're kind of high-fiving each other like, hell yeah, big company, drive the industry, show MAM is the right way to go.
Yeah. And then Colin Steele was interviewing somebody from Citrix a few weeks ago. And I think the quote's in there. It's like, we'll put MDM for, you know, the 10% of companies that still aren't comfortable with that, you know, with going with an entirely MAM approach. And it's like
that was actually Jesse Lipson, the guy who ran the CEO of ShareFile before they were acquired. So I'm not actually sure what role he is in at Citrix right now, but apparently it's branched out to MDM a little bit.
Well, and so the funny thing, it's like, you know, people have been doing MDM on iPhones for, you know, for like 3.5 years now, and you've already gotten so entrenched that.
We don't know anything more about it. I mean, is it one of those things where, especially because applying a configuration profile to an iPhone is so simple to do, like it seems like that's kind of a no-brainer. Like, because I mean, it almost feels like I could write this myself, because the configuration profile already exists from Apple, right? So all you need to do is a way to deliver that to the phone. Like, how hard is that?
Right, and then you can use that to do all those configuration things and query the phone for devices. You can use the
query the phone for apps.
Right, and you can use the configuration profile to push apps to the device, and it's still a fairly gentle push. There's still a cancel button, you know, if the user really doesn't want it, and if you use the configuration profile to install an application, you can actually use the configuration profile to remove that application. But once again, all of the kill switch for the application, it should be either built into the, it should be built into the app wrapper. And if you look, there's a video, I think it was with Gary Barton at Synergy. He seemed really cool. Who gave a video on consumerized IT about how the Cloud Gateway app management stuff works. And it's right there in the video. Like there's a kill switch. If IT wants to kill the app, the user can't get in, period. And there's nothing there, nothing left anyway. So if that's all working right, then what do you need MDM to sweep up the bits for?
So accusing's too strong. Are you intimating that maybe their MAM doesn't work as well as they sort of imply, so they might need some MDM to do some
Are you intimating that their MDM doesn't work as well as they are intimating?
They are intimating?
I mean, that's really hard to say because the field of mobile application management is about a year and a half old.
Yeah, it's all, and frankly, they haven't really given us much details either. So this is all speculation.
So if on the one hand, if a company says, "Hey, we want mobile device management in there as well," they might as well say, "Sure, why not?" But it'd be cool if they said, "Hey, we're going to do this purely without purely without configuration profiles," A lot of people, when they say, mobile application management is like the future, and there was, somebody wrote an article like MDM, we hardly knew the, or like MDM is dead. But when they say that, they mean mobile application management, a lot of times like still with configuration profiles. And I don't know if I'm the only one that's making such a big deal out of MAM with configuration profiles, or if other people are not.
Your deal being that, like, guys, if you have a configuration profile in, it's fucking MDM, regardless of what you call it. Like, if your MAM requires a config profile, you got a problem.
So that's the way that I'm feeling right now. I don't know if many other people feel that way. I feel that there's a lot of talk about MAM going on that is not how. How should I put this? There's a lot of talk about how great MAM is and whether or not there's like a layer of a configuration profile involved is not really mentioned.
Mm. So is that like one of the dirty, the questions you ask vendors when you're talking about, when you're getting briefed and stuff?
If their mobile application management uses configuration profiles. Yeah. So, just because configuration profiles are involved doesn't mean that the MAM vendor is going to be the company is going to be the evil overlord.
Yeah.
It just seems like an issue that people should be aware of, especially with BYOD and the ability to query the device for other installed applications, which finding the device people would think finding the device location, like that's a big deal, but any app can find device location. It's the MDM profile itself that gives that that ability.
Well, so,
and of course the like full remote wiping.
Yeah, well, and the potential is there because I never thought of this domain join analogy until right now, but that's it. Like, even if your vendor, your MAM vendor, you're about to explode. What do you want to say?
I am. So, that's. But how many people know that potential that specifically that remote wiping potential? How many people know that exists already with Exchange Active Sync? You and I know this.
We are in this space, and I learned that from Brian, who learned that from you like a month ago.
Okay, yeah. So that one feature,
they can literally. I know you said this already, but like, I'm holding up my iPhone right here. It's my own phone. I literally bought this with my own money. It's on a Tektronix corporate plan, but like, I got it from Apple, installed it all myself, and all I did was just set up my mail as an Exchange server. So because of that, like, they can remote wipe this phone?
Yes. Now, there's no warning.
No warning. Yeah.
Right. Well, so Colin Steele, when I wrote that article, it was sometime last week, but Colin said that his phone, when he hooked it into Exchange, a warning label popped up. And, you know, once again, that's like with Android phones, different Android devices do different things in different ways. And so it's confusing and who the heck knows what's going on. But so good for the manufacturer of his phone that they stuck that warning flag in there.
Oh yeah. So I've actually heard
like zero anecdotes of this actually happening.
I guess the nerd in me really wants to fire up an Exchange server and try this out.
Why don't we just walk down to Howard and do it on my phone right now?
I've been thinking about going down to, you know, yeah, to our local admin Howard here, and
I don't want to let him know that that's possible. I will say, so I actually got a message one time from our Exchange server, which is different than yours. I go to the one that's in Boston, but I got a message from that thing one time that said I needed to put a password on my device. They did. So they enforced the policy and said you can't get email anymore until you put a passcode on your device. So I did that. And then just for the hell of it, I took it off again, and I could still get email, and I haven't had to put one on there since. Like, I mean, I have, but not. I haven't been required to. I just put it on there because it makes sense. But at the time, I just tried it. So they must have just turned the policy on for a second and then turned it off again. So they tried. So I think they know that there's some capabilities there, but I don't know how much they actually use them, and I don't know how many organizations know that they can do this either.
Yeah. There's a commenter in the chat room used it when a user lost their phone. Somebody else says it do it through OWA, or just, you know, yeah, like a third party client app. That way your IT department can't see.
Oh, no
phone.
Shit. Just,
and the third, you know, like they must, you know.
There's a lot of third-party mail apps and stuff for iOS. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are plenty out there that you can make it report to Exchange, like whatever device state you want it to report.
Yeah, well, the
it's
thing
like,
is, so
oh, with, yeah, we have a password.
With OWA, though, it just uses web parts. So every one of those, every single thing in OWA is independently addressable, and so you can have a client that uses all the OWA data on the backside, and then it just renders it differently for you in a pretty way on the phone. So that's not even using Exchange ActiveSync or anything other than regular old Outlook web access. That's where – do you remember that company, Jack? I think it was MobiliSafe that actually put a little proxy on the Exchange – on the OWA or Exchange ActiveSync front-end server and then could watch and kind of categorize a device based on like the network – requests that went through it would know, like, iOS 5 versus 5.1 versus whether this was jailbroken or not. Like, there were enough little differences, some nuances that they could tell. And then that software alone was actually it would take that whatever that traffic was, whatever that signature it generated, send that off to a cloud service that spun that and then could allow or deny that device access based on whatever the network traffic was. So there wasn't any actual on-device intelligence there, but it was still a way to manage whether that device had access without actually having the ability to remote wipe it. You just said yes or no.
Yeah. And I thought that stuff was really cool because you're figuring out more about the device than you can. To figure out that much about the device, you'd either have to have an app on the device or something else. And maybe you make it like your company's like corporate expense app or something also happens to, like, you know, do an FYI, like, this app is also going to check, like, to see if the device is jailbroken. And, you know, maybe we'll let IT know about that.
Yeah.
Well, even if there was an agent, like an on-device agent for that thing, but still didn't maybe have full management wipe your device kind of capabilities, you know, that there's still a lot of power in that. Just denying access to corporate data in the data center based on, you know, or at the network level, but the app can still live on the device and the user can still have full control over it. I mean, there's use cases for every one of these things that we're talking about, I guess. So, but that was definitely one unique approach that I liked.
Yeah, yeah. So the question that I want to ask this one more time is, like, when we boil things down, the question is, how do we feel about configuration profiles on personal devices?
Yeah, and that's as I said,
are you willing to make that trade-off, like, if it's in exchange for more access to company resources or something?
And the question is, so for users, will they be nervous to know that? So even as you said, some MAM vendors might use configuration profiles just to sort of help out with their MAM stuff. But since as a user, you don't get to pick what that config profile can do or not do. So whether it's a disclosure thing from IT or is it just in general, like, are users comfortable? Like, if they put a real config profile on my machine, on my phone, would I be comfortable giving them that much control, knowing they could sort of at that point, like, do whatever they want to do and scan what I'm doing and that kind
right.
of thing?
And when you put that config profile on a device, the a warning definitely does pop up.
So the question is, so right now, if just simply using Exchange Active Sync means that the company can wipe the phone, like, I'm probably more okay. Like, I'm okay with the company being able to wipe my phone, but if I knew that they could, like, look at everything I did on the phone, maybe I'd be less.
But what if they said, well, Joe Admin can't see that list of applications, so.
Right, it's only who? Arden? She's our HR VP.
can they see all the different texts that you've sent and all of that stuff, or pictures in your photo, your camera, your photo library or whatever? Like, I don't know. I see.
Well, some of that stuff they need an app to see, but.
But they could push the app out then.
Right. And I would say that users are getting more and more, I've said this a billion times, savvy with all this stuff too. So, like, if it's Joe guy that's got 25 years in the company and, just wants the phone that can give him email, he doesn't care about that. But if I got a kid coming out of college, it has his Facebook and all of his pictures, and I mean, he just lives on his phone, I don't think I want to give the company access to be able to do anything with that data. And so I feel like right now that might be acceptable, but in the future it won't be.
And that's a million-dollar question that this all boils down to. And so I guess
Are you exploring this in your book? So Jack is writing a book about MDM and MAM and BYO device and everything. Are you sort of getting into these political, cultural, philosophical issues as well?
I am writing a book about this right now, and I will be exploring these issues. But basically, like, this, that, that technical background information of what the configuration profile can actually do, using that information to inform that political, cultural discussion will be what is unique about this book, I believe.
Incidentally, all these configuration profiles, that's an iOS-only thing. So what does Android have?
So Android, you have an agent application that can access the various APIs, but those, they vary between implementations, and the basic ones are all pretty much the same. It's just a much more difficult world to get into, and it just requires digging into devices and devices from different manufacturers to know what's actually available.
It's interesting that, so all these conversations, we're talking about iOS config profiles, I asked about Android, so there's other things out there. I mean, what else even comes up? Like, I guess the other ones are just Windows and BlackBerry. Like, do those, QNX is delayed, another, BlackBerry 10 is,
yeah,
who knows where that's going, but
some of the MDM companies, a lot of them, they talk about Windows Mobile and Windows Phone and Symbian and WebOS And, you know, what was that article I read about, like the Firefox phone OS?
Oh, yeah. But so, okay. So the other ones that have actual market share is what? It's BlackBerry and Windows?
Yeah.
Does Windows Phone have like config profiles or similar kind of thing? Or, hell, maybe maybe those are literally
domain.
Yeah, maybe they're literally domain joined.
they've got the System Center stuff to manage them.
It's a lot more of the a lot more of the, you know, vertically integrated stack model, but that's another whole world that that I sure haven't spent any time in.
So I can't imagine. There's that, and then the Surface tablets, that those came out while I was on vacation. But so now I've got to worry about those things too. And I mean, that's what a crazy world it's got to be at Microsoft, right?
Well, I'm guessing for the Surface tablets, since those are running the same OSs, like if it's Windows Pro, then you're going to run, that's Intel domain based. And if you're WinRT on ARM, then that's the conversation we had before, where that's not domain joined, but I'm sure they'll have the same APIs for management, just like they do in the Windows Phone, because Windows Phone is ARM based, so it's the same, it's the same OS.
So speaking of Surface tablet and crazy time at Microsoft right now, that Tim Mangan yesterday, that report from the something or whatever conference. I don't know. They have conferences every other week. So
the Worldwide Partner Conference.
But he mentioned the distinct lack of mentioning of the Surface tablet.
Well, and, sure, because Microsoft is fucking the partners with. No, because Microsoft is screwing the partners with this thing, so they don't want to mention it during the partner conference. They're like, sorry about that.
I think the line from Ballmer was something like, it reduced down to something along the lines of like, it's a really big pie, so you know we're not trying to take too much of it.
Yeah, right. Except, well, what did you want to? what was Jack's name or suggested title for the article that Brian wrote? Like Ballmer to partners, you can build a tablet that's better than ours, but it'll cost $80 more. Or
slightly, yeah,
I forget what it was, but it was more snarky than that, and was awesome too. But I just can't believe. So what I read briefly was that Microsoft is going to build this thing directly, so they're not going to have to pay the licensing fee, right? So now they can make the exact same tablet as Asus, but it's going to be $80 cheaper.
And,
which is asinine. That totally screws the partners. And then there's no other way to say that. There's no spin that Microsoft can put on it. There's no nothing. That screws their partners.
And also remember that Microsoft – so what we haven't gotten yet – so this Windows Store where you're going to be able to buy applications from and I assume media at some point and content, which – so it doesn't quite exist yet.
Great, another store.
Well, yeah. But I mean it is, right? So, But the thing is, so they'll make money on that, presumably. But what we still haven't heard from Microsoft yet is if a partner makes a tablet, will the partner get a cut of everything that the user buys from that device on that store? But what about they buy an Asus tablet and then – but you bought the software per account, so if you have other devices – because where I'm going with this is Microsoft can also afford to sell these things at a loss and then make money on the store, which is exactly like what they did in the Xbox in the early days.
Yeah.
But other partners cannot afford to sell these things at a loss because if they're not making any money on the store, like that's exactly why you end up with HP with that, you know, $600 MC Hammer thing. What was that thing called? What the hell is that tablet called?
It's already gone off into folklore.
But whatever that thing was.
What was that thing called?
But it was so expensive because you couldn't and with Apple buying, you know, committing to make purchases that are, you know, locking up vendors for decades, they can build. I mean, Apple can actually make, ironically, they can make a very high quality product and make money on the actual hardware sale. But if Microsoft is going into it, and I think some of the analysts who do like inventory, like the iSupply analysts and stuff, or even though we don't know the specs yet, are saying like for what they're trying to build. And this is like, you know, magnesium or bromium, whatever the thing is made out of, that they that it's going to be like, you know, it's expensive, and so only Microsoft can afford to sell it at the loss. So that's another, it's, well, this
which they can do. I mean, you know, if this thing, do you remember the whole Xbox from the cloud thing?
From Benny. I mean, that's Benny's idea.
Yeah, exactly. And so now they're talking about these like Android devices that, you know, could be an Xbox killer as well, that are $100 go into the TV and You know, there's just so many different things that Microsoft could do with this that they're not just thinking about making a tablet that can surf the web and get email, right? Like, I feel like they've probably got bigger aspirations than that. And so, yeah, I mean, this it's scary how much they could screw the partners over with this kind of a thing.
I also joked in my article, I don't know if you read this, maybe this is while you're on vacation, but I actually got an article on the article I did for this was on Reddit. And it got 10,000 views in the first 24 hours. It's the first time I broke 10,000 in 24 hours.
No shit. I saw it had a lot of views, but like, congrats, dude.
So
you got slashed at it one time a long time ago too, right?
During Briform 1, yeah. Okay. And the
HP touchpad. Thanks, Chaz.
Hey, Justin, can you close the door in here? Because I hear all these kitchen noise in this room. The servers, the other thing, speaking of partners they're screwing, the retail partners too. So you can only buy it from the Microsoft store online or the physical Microsoft retail store. So even like poor Best Buy and all them who are struggling, and like finally there's like some consumer device that maybe people are going to want from Microsoft, and it's like, no, you can't get the here. You can buy the shittier, more expensive ones at your store, but which again, I think they almost need to do because they can't, like that way, that's again, I don't know what retail margin, like when Best Buy sells a laptop, I don't know what cut they take. By Microsoft selling it direct, that's that much less money they need to give to a retail partner as well.
I don't think they're making any money at the store on devices like that. I don't think they're making a penny.
They make their money on stoves,
and cables and service plans,
warranties,
and crap like
that.
I mean, and this is why Best Buy is closing stores and moving into mall kiosks and stuff. I mean, that Best Buy, I would be willing to bet you that Best Buy makes more money off those damn vending machines at the airports than they do off of a store.
That's a good point. Hey, you know, I lost my faith in Best Buy the day that they tried to sell me, convince me I need to buy a gold-plated optical cable. And I'm like, or any digital cable for that matter. But like, I was buying one for the little like Toslink cable, and there's one like Monster one that's like gold-plated, and he talks about how the connector. And I'm like, you know what this thing does, right? Like,
but
most of the other ones
gold.
Are plastic.
Yeah.
Like, the, like Monster still coats the plastic tips, like the bezel. Or, anyway. So the Surface thing, well, we can just put that to – I mean, it's fine. Like, you know, it'll be a nice product. But the whole idea, like, that this is going to – like, what I don't get is Windows RT and Metro UI and all these things have been – out and announced. And that's all this thing run. All the service things are just running that. So this is purely like the sexier hardware. And I just don't know if that's enough to. I don't know. Well,
and I still think it's going to get Microsofted up.
You know, yeah,
I still think we're gonna go through all of this crap, and Microsoft is gonna deliver us a Kindle Fire.
I know I'm gonna have to peel a sticker off that thing when I.
that's what I was just gonna ask.
Yeah, like that's, they want to take it from Apple. How about take that? Like, don't have like 15 stickers on what graphics card I have in it, and like whose USB stick is inside and everything. So, so that whole service. We'll see. I don't know. We'll play with it. It's good job.
At least they found a use for that name.
Yeah. Incidentally, by the way, we're almost out of time. I guess we don't have to stop exactly, but I want to say this is what's interesting about this show this week is we spent the bulk of the show talking about the MDM and device management and mobile stuff. And during that conversation, five or six different people in the chat room were sort of chiming into that. And the screen I'm looking at only showed like 15 to 20 people in the chat room in general. So where I'm going with this is this means that, because, you know, I've always wondered, like, is this two separate markets? Like, is there sort of like the quote-unquote like desktop market and the mobile market? Are these two different things? And they have been kind of two different areas back in the past. But, you know, as we started looking on the website and with our focus on Briform and stuff, we've been sort of starting to bring these more together because we started to realize
we tried to treat them separately too with having two websites and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's just coming to the point where it's just not it, like this is like, I think that the amount of conversation we had around this, the mobile device stuff, is the same. It just shows that, yeah, this is not two separate markets really. Like the same people who are responsible for desktops are responsible for, you know, the mobile devices. So, I can't read what that says. Gigo gig. Is that like giggity gig? Posting Microsoft announced the details of Windows Server 2012 licensing, two editions now. That's literally cut and paste from potential topics we could talk about. And I'm guessing you cut and paste that because you want us to talk about it.
That's weird because that's exactly what's in our talking points.
Yeah,
doc.
Guess where I cut and pasted the talking points doc from.
Okay.
So, but let's talk about that because we can go over because it's just the internet. Since giggity gig was chatting earlier, I'm game. The details. So I actually read the whole, well, it wasn't super long, but that like 20-page document, that PDF that Microsoft released around the Windows Server 2012 licensing. Did you guys see this? Or did you hear the announcements?
You're looking at me.
All right. Gabe, did you read this thing? Did you hear this
thing? I did not read it.
So here's the gist. So Server 2012, they're only two licenses now, Data Center and Standard. And what's interesting is from a feature standpoint, all the features are identical. So it used to be like there was a web edition where you could only run web workloads. Then there's Standard. Then there's Enterprise Edition, which had like high availability and some different capabilities that were added to it. And then there's Data Center, which had this the same features as Enterprise, but then also like allowed you to run like unlimited everything. So what Microsoft finally said is let's move away from all this garbage of different features and different versions. And now from a pure, like from the bits standpoint, there's only one set of bits for Windows Server now. It's web, enterprise, standard, data center, all the same bits. It's like 100% same features, sort of all identical. And then there's just two different editions for licensing. Windows, the standard edition allows you to run two VMs, and the data center edition allows you to run unlimited VMs. But now here's what's interesting. With both of these editions, are are for two physical processors. So if you buy a server with four physical processors in it, you got to buy like two licenses of Windows Server. And again, you can buy two licenses of a data center, or you can buy two licenses of standard. But it's like basically one server license. You need one server license per every two processors you have. And again, eight processors in the machine, which I guess they still make those. You need four Windows licenses on that machine. But what's interesting then, so with standard, every standard license also only allows you to run two VMs. So if you have four, the pricing difference, a data center price was like $3,500, I think, and standard was like $800. So if you want to run, if you have like two processors, you only need, one server license for that. But if you want to run four VMs on that machine, then you need to have, you need to buy like two standard licenses, because buying two standard licenses will still be cheaper than buying a data center license. And the two standard license allows you to run the four VMs.
So no more $28 Hyper-V. Remember when it came out, it was a $28 add-on or something?
Yeah.
And so now this is actually Microsoft getting paid for the hypervisor, which, they deserve it.
But what's weird about this to me, like the craziest, I don't know, but but the one thing lacking, and thanks for posting this link to the ZDNA article. I hadn't seen this, but Mary Jo, we've all been following her for 15 years. She's pretty good at understanding Microsoft and summarizing all this stuff.
You ever met her? I've never met her.
I have.
I've been in the same building as her, but never actually got a chance to meet her.
I met her at the Worldwide Partner Conference of Microsoft, actually, which is maybe the one that Tim's at. I met her in New Orleans in 2003 at that one.
I actually met her at TechEd.
Oh, cool. The one thing that's weird about licensing to me is you still can't. So to be clear, you're licensing Windows based on physical processor. So again, and I guess they have to pick some kind of thing, but it's physical processor of the host machine. Like you can't license Windows on a Windows VM. Like I would think that if we were truly going towards like cloud-based licensing or whatever, it'd be like you license like per instance of Windows, and like you can like run that wherever.
Yeah.
But if you have a whole bunch of machines and you want to run that Windows kind of wherever, then you need to buy them. Like you just need to license all your physical machines that might run Windows. But it's kind of brilliant, because again, if you go back, and I know this probably isn't that super realistic, but like the fantasy of like you have all these servers, they're all running a hypervisor and they're all like interchangeable. So if you have like a whole vSphere infrastructure and you're moving your workloads like dynamically from machine to machine to machine, now you have to license every goddamn one of those for Windows, Whereas if they sold it to you where you could like buy like a Windows like VM license, like because if you know if you're all running Microsoft Hypervisor, that doesn't matter. But if it's a vSphere infrastructure and I want to run Windows, like when you run Windows on one, that's it. You need a license for that, license for next one, license for that next one. So Microsoft kind of says, oh, this licensing is more consistent and more flexible. But really it just means that it's more consistent and flexible, comma, as long as you basically buy enough Windows licenses for every processor in your entire company. And then, hey, you can do whatever you want with it. But I don't know that – I don't get really like – I don't know. I don't want to seem so like anti-Microsoft, but it still feels like it's changed, but it's not like – I don't know if it's necessarily any better. You know, it seems like to be better for them.
Well, so spell this out then. So I have a data center server that I'm going to run 10 terminal server VMs on.
Uh-huh.
Right? So I need 4 processors, say, for that.
Yeah.
Right? And the retail is like $5,000 just to round up.
Yeah, yeah.
So that $5,000 entitles me to run all of those, but I need to buy 2 of those, right?
Correct.
So now I need $10,000 worth of licenses, but then I can install the OS as many times as I want.
Right, on that hardware. Yeah.
On that hard, right. Yeah. As long as I don't go beyond those processors as
correct.
Far as
correct.
Capacity. Goes.
Correct. And then, of course, RDS cals are all still the same. Windows cals and RDS cals remain unchanged.
Right.
So,
I mean, you know, it's – so the limitation as far as the processors is kind of odd, I guess. I mean, we'd have to, like, look at – do real math and see how that shakes out, but compared to other things out there. But the fact that you don't have you buy the Windows license one time and you don't have to keep on buying it aside from the processor limitation. But
I guess that's true. Yeah. So then you're buying it whenever you buy new hardware. So I guess on that standpoint,
right. So if you pay $5,000 for a 2 processor data center license and you can run 10 VMs on that, you're paying, you know, if you boil that down to like price per OS instance, it's not that much.
But data center, but that's how data center, but that's no different because data center has always been unlimited VMs.
It has, but it's also not been, people don't usually go there, you know, like.
Right, because there's other options that were less expensive.
Right.
But now you don't have those other options.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, we're looking at standard's pretty restrictive. You know, if you're only allowed to run 2 VMs, then, but even that's cheaper. I mean, if you had to.
Standard's going to be 800
virtualized
something.
Infrastructure on yeah. standard. So, you know, I don't know. Like I said, it would take some real math. I could see where this might work out to be okay. But
I guess
we'd have to figure it
and
out.
And it is more consistent with other Microsoft products. So like SQL and Exchange and System Center, they're all moving to this kind of processor-based licensing. So, the problem if you charge on licenses per instance, and that just encourages people to build fewer, larger instances. But, I mean, I guess fundamentally that's what this is now. Like Windows has essentially gone to a physical processor license model, except for CALs. So that's another thing, too. Like, why do you still need CALs? Because you got to buy CALs for all these things. So why don't you just build all the costs into the CALs and, like, let me run as much Windows as I need? Like, I love that Citrix does that, you know? You just pay for the CALs and let me run as many Windows as I need to make all that work. And then you could have also a lower expensive CAL for like the web, because they still have the web. So if you're running a web workload, then you don't need to have CALs. Because I don't know if you knew that like the CALs were like whatever, they're like $30 each, which is meant for if you're connecting to the server and using it like as a real user. But if you have a website, you don't want to pay $30 per user who accesses your website. So they say, well, if they're only accessing like web workloads, like via HTTP and stuff, then you can do it unlimited built in the Windows license. You don't need a separate license for that. I guess if they went the CAL base, then that goes, that's the whole like user based licensing, which Microsoft just isn't into. So, I guess that's that. But anyway, so that's 2012. I guess it's simpler, but it just seems like still like, cause it's, I mean, it's still weird with like licenses from suppliers. I mean, you know, if you want to move your stuff into the cloud, now it's like, well, I got to have their license or my license. And I don't know.
I was sitting here trying to think about, cause now there's the, you run the Windows instances in the cloud in Azure. And so I wonder if they're setting up for something there by changing this around a little bit. And I can't think of any way that works, but still, I just wonder if this is part of a bigger plan eventually. I don't know why they change it into intermediate things, though, and why they wouldn't just change it all to one thing and, you know, you pay for whatever you pay for, no matter where the workload is. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. So but this whole this whole sort of, like, fantasy about, like, Windows 2012, I mean, and Benny writes a lot about this. You know, I guess they're going in that direction about making it sort of a more cloud-based OS, but it's not there. I mean, like, Server 2012 is not going to be the sort of OS of the cloud. Nor is it licensed that way. All right, so that's that. I don't have anything else to say on that Windows licensing, apart from I was just...
All right, next time we should drag the show, we should drag the licensing stuff out early and then build up from there. Because, man...
Could we end on a downer?
Well, so I'm just looking at our talking points here. What's this Nicole's test email from Bromium? Because I'm just guessing it's funny, and I don't know what the hell it is.
So okay, so it. Nicole Poplo, she's one of our coworkers here in the office. So Jack and I are sitting there earlier today, and she just kind of laughs, and we're all sitting in, like, cubicle land, you know, and we're like, what's up? And she's like, she goes, I just got this email. And she's like, it says, subject, you have urgent work. And it says, hi, comma, Ikley. We got today a letter from tax department. They writing that we have not paid all needed taxes. You must urgent clear this shit. Other way, they are freeze our bank accounts. I scanned the letter for you. You will find it in attach. Clear situation this and write me back. And then it has, like, details.zip. And Nicole, who's a sales rep, you know, was like, yeah, I'm clicking on that attachment. and then Jack says to me, hey, you still have that Bromium laptop? And I'm like, oh, hey, look at that. So that's because, you know, we played with Bromium. So we have one of the Bromium laptops. And I was playing with it to kind of see it working, which is cool. But it's, I mean, I'm just playing with it, right? And I'm like, okay, now I for sure want to open this attachment on Bromium and see what happens. So that's that's
oh,
that's
you
that story.
Done that yet?
Yeah, okay. I haven't done it yet. Yeah,
gotcha. All right. Well, I think that's all.
Yeah,
that's all I've got. Broadform's coming up in a couple of weeks. I don't know if we're gonna do one next week. No, we're not, because you're coming here and then leaving right at about showtime next week. So no show next week. I'm sure we'll. Well, yeah, I don't know. Are we gonna throw something together, Broadform?
Yeah, we can do something Broadform. And we can figure out. We can see if we can get a show in next week. Maybe do it like an hour earlier or something. But anyway,
well, I think you fly out at 11, which means you got to be out of here like 9:30. I don't know.
Well, regardless, we'll have some show at some point in the future.
Yes.
So on that, thanks everyone for hanging in there who is with the conversation. And I wrote down a list of like 5 or 6 articles based on the conversations today. So this is good stuff. Jack, thanks for chiming in with all the MDM stuff.
Yep.
I learned a lot from that. And good luck with your book.
Thank you.
And Gabe, I'm visiting you. I will see you. Oh, by the way, tomorrow's Gabe's birthday. So just a preview on that. And I will see you, Gabe.
It doesn't. At 33, you just don't care anymore.
Anyway, I'll see you this weekend, Gabe. Thanks all for listening. Brian and Gabe and Jack Live. See you later.
See ya.